Hello, and welcome to episode 92 of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. We are here today with David Azarat, director of the B. Kenneth Simon Center for Principles and Politics and the AWC Family Foundation Fellow at the Heritage Foundation. David, how are you doing today?
I'm doing quite well. Thank you for having me on your show.
Glad to have you. The first thing I'd like to ask you is, what are you currently doing, or what have you ever done to advance the public interest, and why?
Well, that's a big question. So I've been here at the Heritage Foundation for 6 years. Heritage, as you and your listeners may know, is the largest conservative think tank in America. Mm-hmm. And I run a part of Heritage that deals in basically American political thought from the founding until today. Mm-hmm. And the bulk of my work and the center's work, I have six people working with me, mm-hmm. is to promote a sound understanding of America's founding principles, to defend the Constitution, and to present a rhetorically compelling, principled, and well-grounded account of conservatism in the 21st century. That's the bulk of our work, and I think it matters insofar as my understanding of what we're doing is defending the American regime and helping conservatives better understand what it is they stand for and articulating it in a more compelling way.
What is it that conservatives stand for, and how do you articulate it in a more compelling way?
So the definitions of conservatism are very hard to come by. There's the kind of the garden variety one of someone who, you know, is partial to the status quo and doesn't really want to change very much. That doesn't really make sense in the 21st century in America, because we've had basically a century of progressive liberalism, the various waves of progressivism.
Does that include when there have been Republicans? And I'm not sure if you would equate Republicans with conservatism.
No, so, I wouldn't.
Okay.
Richard Nixon consolidated the New Deal. Uh-huh. George Bush called himself a compassionate conservative, but, you know, he wasn't anchored in the principles of limited constitutional government. So I don't really look at it in terms of the parties. I look at it in terms of the ideas.
Have there been any conservatives in high elected offices in the 20th century?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think Ronald Reagan is the shining example, and that's why he's captured the imagination of so many conservatives. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Goldwater, although he failed to win an election but was a senator, I think spoke the language of conservatism. But so if you look at what happened in the course of the 20th century, is you had successive waves mm-hmm. of progressivism that reconfigured the country. FDR and the New Deal was a very big one. LBJ gave us the Great Society. The cultural upheaval of the 60s, I mean, some of its excesses were reined in, but many of its ideas, you know, penetrated the mainstream.
For the worse.
Well, for the worse, if you're a conservative mm-hmm. on the whole, for the worse in two ways. One is a growth in the size, scope, and reach of the federal government. Mm-hmm. And second is an erosion of civil society, and the two usually go hand in hand. I mean, this was Tocqueville's warning about...
For our listeners, Alexis de Tocqueville was a 19th century French citizen who explored America and published his famous tome, Democracy in America.
Which has been called both the best book ever written about democracy and the best book ever written about America. And it ends with a warning about what he sees as the threat that can happen in a democracy, and he calls it democratic despotism. And it's basically a hollowing out of the middle layers of society that leaves you with a society in which you have a towering state presiding over a collection of fragmented individuals that are pretty much wholly self-absorbed in their private pursuits. And the mediating institutions of family, community, local government, state governments are all eroded. Mm-hmm. And what you really have is the state and the individual. So I think that for a conservative, look, there were some great things that happened in the 20th century. I mean, the end of segregation is one obvious one. I'm not saying all that happened is bad. But the general thrust has been an erosion of constitutional government and a weakening of civil society. So that if you're a conservative in the 21st century, you don't necessarily just want to defend the status quo and conserve things just as they are.
You want to strengthen civil society.
Yeah, you want to undo many things. You're in favor of many reforms. Mm-hmm. And then conversely, the left generally, I mean, there are various strands to the left, wants to protect all of its achievements.
Mm-hmm.
So you kind of have the tables turned in many regards, where the left is saying no to many reforms,
mm-hmm.
and the right is pushing the reforms. All this to say that how to define conservatism and progressivism in the 21st century in America is by no means an easy task. Because you can't just say, well, you know, conservatives defend the status quo and the progressives want to argue for change, because it depends on the issue. The left progressives can be quite conservatives.
Uh-huh.
You know, look at the issue of school choice and charter schools and education reform.
Uh-huh.
And then on that issue, conservatives are actually quite progressive, if not radical at times, and really want to upset the way we do things.
So I'm interested in getting a little bit back to you, David. You mentioned that there's been a deterioration in civil society and that this is something that's been to the detriment of our nation. So I'm quite interested in hearing, why is it that this is of particular concern to you individually, especially within the context of your personal background?
That's a great question. So as you can tell from my accent, I'm not from here. I'm from north of the border. I'm from Montreal in Quebec in Canada. And I came to the U.S. 12 years ago, a little over 12 years ago, to do a PhD in political theory in Texas, and have been in D.C. now for 8 years. I'm not yet a citizen. I'm a permanent legal resident. Yet I'm very attached to this country. I came here, I think, with the views that most Canadians have, that, you know, America is this huge country to the south of us that just sucks up all the air in the room, but that Americans are nice people. But I don't think I have very strong views about America one way or another. And what happened over the course of my studies and over the course of living here is I fell in love with this country, with its history, the founding, and more importantly, its people. I think Americans have many admirable qualities, and I've grown very attached to this regime to the point where I see my future here. I aspire to become a citizen. I would like to raise children here and for them to be Americans one day. And as such, I would like them to inherit what I see is best in this country. And, you know, there's a tendency when people speak of America to kind of reduce it to a land of opportunity, which it is. But in my mind, I come from Canada. There are plenty of opportunities in Canada. Okay, mm-hmm. The idea that if, you know, you start off poor and you work hard, you can make money, that doesn't capture the soul of America, because many other countries offer that.
Mm-hmm.
To me, where America really stands out, what I'm most attracted to, is that, as Tocqueville said, Americans have mastered the science of association. What I see in America, I mean, look, there are many things I like about this country, but this is one in particular that stands out, is the civic spirit.
Mm-hmm.
Americans donate, volunteer, join more than anyone else in the world that I've seen. The mentality I see in America, which I didn't see in Quebec growing up, is if there's a problem in your community,
mm-hmm.
the default setting isn't, well, I paid my taxes, let someone else take care of that. The default setting, what I see in America, is no, let's do something about it. And Americans have this marvelous capacity for self-government in the strict literal sense of the term, that they govern themselves and their communities. And I think there's something admirable about that, because it displays civic spirit. There's a certain manliness it reveals about citizens being in control of their own lives. And it benefits everyone, because instead of having faraway bureaucrats who really don't know their conditions on the ground addressing local problems, you have communities dealing with them. I mean, they're the ones who are closest to the problem. So when I think of the pillars of conservatism, is the idea of federalism, subsidiarity, localism, the idea that people who are closest to the problem should be the ones trying to address it.
So I hear you saying that there's you have an admiration for local communities having ownership of their own issues, their own communities, and therefore you have an admiration for federalist principles that basically decentralize and localize government, and that people on the ground. And so when you lamented the decline of civil society, were you insinuating that there is a stronger federal government now than there has been before, and that has been to the detriment of local government?
Yeah, and not just local government, to the detriment of families, of churches, of civic associations. I think that, you know, one of the things that Charles Murray documented in his book Coming Apart, which is probably the most important book published on the right in the past 5-6 years, and definitely the most talked about one, is this idea that America, you know, has, there are two Americas. In one America, civic virtues remain strong, mm-hmm. families are strong, religious attendance is high. And then there's another America in which these mediating institutions of civil society have deteriorated. So that it's not just a, taking a jab at the federal government. It's lamenting the decline of strong societies, the collapse of families, the collapse of civic associations, so that you have a hollowing out of civil society, and you see that happening in many parts of the country. And this issue transcends race, because you'll see it in some, you know, black urban neighborhoods, mm-hmm. and you'll also see it in some white rural neighborhoods. So it, I think it less has to do with race and more has to do with socioeconomic status.
And the reason why this is so important to you is because you feel as though the very essence of what America is, the example that we give to the rest of the world, is actually being threatened at its essence.
Well, even true, but even more importantly, I care about this because lives are ruined. Mm. Because human flourishing is at stake.
That please elaborate on that.
Well, look, you know, I'm 38 years old. I don't claim to have a grand comprehensive theory of happiness. Mm-hmm. But I do have a sense of what thriving community looks like. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't look like broken families, massive dependency on the federal government, very low labor force participation rates, low civic engagement, and widespread abuse of drugs. Mm-hmm. And when I see that, the first thing that pains me is not that, oh, this is a waste of federal dollars. The first thing that pains me is not, oh, this is unconstitutional. It's that these are my fellow citizens.
So it's compassion.
Yeah, it's compassion. I mean, you know, I don't see why the left should have a monopoly on compassion. Or on the heart that, you know, this is America, we care for one another, and some parts of the country are not doing well. And that bothers me. And the reason I'm a conservative is that I really believe at the end of the day that if conservative policy solutions were implemented, mm-hmm. All Americans would be better off.
So could we talk a little bit about some of these conservative policy solutions that you are supporting in your work at the Heritage Foundation? And let me also add on to that question, are you looking for policy solutions at the federal level, or does it seem like county, municipal, state level policy solutions are really what you're trying to go for?
So I don't deal in I mean, Heritage is a public policy institution. I don't have a policy area of expertise. As I told you, I cover the big picture, mm-hmm. of the big ideas mm-hmm. that shape and move American politics from the founding until today. That said, the vision is very much, let me use a word that you don't often hear on the right, is I'm for diversity. Mm. So I'm for, I believe I would want these communities to be strengthened because mm-hmm. That's a precondition for human flourishing. But once that's done, how they choose to govern themselves mm-hmm. in a vast country that spans a continent and is home to some 320 million people, you are not going to have a one-size-fits-all top-down approach to policy that is right for all Americans.
So
localism, federalism, devolution of power, subsidiarity, various localism, what this means is there are certain core issues mm-hmm. on which we as a nation cannot disagree. Foreign policy is one of them. I don't want Vermont declaring war on Canada. I don't want Alabama signing a treaty with Mexico.
Okay. But and that's pretty, outlined in the Constitution.
Exactly. Article 1, Section 8 are basically the powers entrusted to Congress. And what we're saying, look, on these, we speak in one voice. But I would argue that on pretty much everything, all the other contentious issues that divide us as Americans, mm-hmm. why not allow for diversity? Why not let Texas be Texas and Vermont be Vermont and let the American people vote with their feet? Some states will have a very high minimum wage. Others will have a lower one. Some states will have very stringent environmental protections. Others won't. Some states will redefine marriage to recognize gay marriages. Others will stand by the traditional definition of marriage, and so on and so forth. What I'm in effect calling for is, why not let Americans in the 21st century customize their government? You pretty much get to customize everything else in your life.
Yeah.
Why not allow for more diversity and more choice when it comes to that? And here's the interesting thing. In the 18th century, it was very hard to vote with your feet. Today, it's much easier.
By voting with your feet, David means moving to another location.
Yeah. So, you know, if you as a citizen feel that, you know, the state of Arizona is not being governed in a way that you like it, well, it is possible. I mean, you should get involved and, you know, try to change it. But if at the end of the day you really can't stand it,
you can move.
You can move. But if we adopt an alternative approach where we say, look, all of the most contentious issues in this country need to be resolved in Washington, D.C., preferably by the Supreme Court, right? The least democratic branch of our government. How are we supposed to arrive at a consensus? How are we supposed to all get along if we're not allowing more breathing room for disagreement? America is not a country. It's a continent. I mean, of course it's a country. I say that flippantly. It's so big, so diverse. We're not going to arrive at a consensus on everything.
So two questions popped to mind. You mentioned earlier that a great example of progress in the 20th century was desegregation. Now, that happened on a national level. My question for you is, what is the litmus test for a conservative in determining whether there ought to be a local solution or a national solution, especially if it is not enumerated in the U.S. Constitution?
That's an excellent question. So segregation was unconstitutional because it violated the 14th Amendment. There was a defect in the original Constitution, which Madison, the father of the Constitution, was well aware of. Namely, the national government had no power to protect citizens if the states were violating their rights. As you may know, the Bill of Rights only applied to the national government.
And that's why, actually, the Articles of Confederation were changed to the U.S. Constitution, which was to give the federal government a little bit more power to enforce its laws in different states.
Yes, but it did not give it what Madison wanted. He called it a national negative, which is a power to say, well, look, if it's wrong to violate religious liberty, it should be wrong if Congress does it or if the, you know, the state legislature.
New Hampshire does.
Exactly.
Okay.
But there was a defect in the original Constitution that was remedied by the 14th Amendment, which was ratified after the Civil War. Regrettably, the 14th Amendment was completely gutted by the Supreme Court in the infamous Plessy v. Ferguson case that said, oh, no, separate but equal is fine. States are allowed to use the power of the law to discriminate and to forbid citizens from voluntarily associating with one another, from working together, from marrying with one another. That was undone, but that's constitutional. I mean, segregation violated the Constitution. So in response to your question, here's the way to think about it. Once an issue arises, unless Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution says Congress should address it, it should be dealt with at the state level. And the states can pretty much do anything they want so long as it doesn't violate the Constitution.
And that's the 10th Amendment.
It's the 10th Amendment. It's also the 14th Amendment. And it's also the Bill of Rights that has now been applied to the states. With Congress, it's the exact opposite. According to the Constitution, Congress can only do what the Constitution empowers it to do.
Right.
So the states have wide, and by the states, by the way, I also mean to include the localities. So I wouldn't be particularly happy with centralized power in 50 states because the states are pretty big and there's a lot of diversity within the states. So I would like the states to push it down to the local level.
The more local, the better.
So you can't allow for violations of rights at the local or state level. That goes without saying. But within the strictures of the Constitution, you give local and state governments and civil society a lot of breathing room.
So I have a follow-up question to something else that you had said earlier, which speaks about this issue of localism and federalism. You mentioned that there shouldn't be a national solution, but there should be individual solutions in different states and localities. And you said, you know, there may be, you don't like the minimum wage in one state, you can go somewhere else. Now, you are a conservative, self-identified.
Guilty as charged.
So what I'd like to ask you is, suppose there's some location, be it a state, a municipality, a county, or some other jurisdiction, that would prefer to enact policies that are anathema to conservative politics, where you're going to have a progressive policy, where you're going to have a minimum wage, where conservative may think that would stifle business or regulations that would prevent business, or something that you think may deteriorate families or lead to more drug addiction, things that you don't agree with. How do you respond?
That's an excellent question. My response is very simple. I live in a free country. Mm-hmm. Which means that the people, via their elected representatives, mm-hmm. at the appropriate level of government, mm-hmm. are free to govern themselves as they see fit. Mm-hmm. I believe that I should try to convince them to adopt conservative solutions because I think they work better. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, mm-hmm. if the people of Vermont want to pass policies that I think will undermine civil society or not be good for economic growth... Mm-hmm. It's a free country. I don't get to overrule the people of Vermont. Mm-hmm. I am willing. Part of signing up for a democracy means I'm willing to accept outcomes that I disagree with. Otherwise, that's not a democracy. If what I'm saying is, well, listen, democracy means everything I believe in gets implemented, well, that's tyranny. Mm-hmm. No, my view is when I signed up for this arrangement, I knew full well that people may view things differently than I do. All I ask is that the rules of the game be obeyed. What worries me today as a conservative is that policy isn't really being made by the rules of the game. That more and more issues are being forced to be resolved at the national level and imposing a one-size-fits-all approach on the whole country. That the courts are addressing many political issues that should be left to the states or Congress to deliberate about, mm-hmm. that many decisions are not even made by our elected representatives. The laws are, you know, basically broad delegations of powers to administrative agencies that are then issuing regulations that have the force of law. So my concern is, yes, with the outcomes, because I believe that conservative policy solutions are best, mm-hmm. but more fundamentally, with the rules of the game. And that's what worries me the most. But at the end of the day, to live in a democracy means I respect the outcomes of my fellow citizens.
Would it be fair to recapitulate your statement as saying there is room within a conservative framework for liberalism to exist where the citizens want it?
Absolutely. There's room for libertarianism to exist. There's room for, you know, light, nonviolent communism to exist. I mean, there's... As I told you, I claim the word diversity and pluralism as a conservative.
And it's not just diversity in terms of demographics, but it could be diversity of opinions and views and values.
I mean, the most interesting kind of diversity, mm-hmm. Of people who disagree about ideas and allow it to flourish. So my, you know, I was asked recently on another interview, you know, what does your America look like? And I said, I don't know what it looks like. It looks like a whole bunch of different things because I don't have a grand master plan mm-hmm. that I want to impose on America. I have strong views that I would urge my fellow Americans to adopt. But at the end of the day, if they don't want to listen to me, I may be mistaken. They may have a better conception of the good. My view of America is, you know, let, to use a line that Mao used, let thousands of flowers bloom.
Mao Zedong.
Yeah, Mao Zedong. but using it in a different context. You know the famous description of the states as laboratories of democracy? Mm-hmm. Justice Brandeis used that in a Supreme Court opinion in the early 20th century. I want a whole bunch of laboratories of democracy.
So, David, as we approach the end of this podcast, I'd like to ask you a final question. You said that you're in your late 30s. You spent a good deal of time considering what it is to be America, what it is to be a conservative. I believe it sounds like you are trying to make this country better for everyone. I'd like to ask you in this final question, why? Why is it that you work so hard to make life better for others, even others who don't know you exist, others who may not agree with you? Why is it that you care so much about public service? And then finally, when you could add on to that, what is your legacy? Not that you're by any means even half through with your career, but let's say one day you will end your career. What is it that you hope to have accomplished throughout the course of your life?
Well, I'm not going to have a legacy. George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, Frederick Douglass, they had a legacy. I'm a nerd in a think tank in Washington. I'm not going to have a legacy. In response to your first question, I do what I do because I'm attached to this country, and I'm attached to my fellow Americans. I'm not yet an American, but I consider them my fellow Americans. And in large part is, if, you know, America didn't have to exist. America, in many regards, is an accident of history. I mean, what are the odds that a ragtag bunch of colonials defeat the strongest army in the world, somehow, you know, fail with their first constitution? You mentioned the Articles of Confederation. Get a second crack at it. Get it right, that Washington doesn't become a tyrant, that Lincoln wins the Civil War. I mean, that this whole country worked is pretty extraordinary. And were America to disappear, there is no guarantee that another one would sprout. So I think there's something special about this country that is worth preserving. I think there's something good about this country that is worth preserving. And in my very, very modest way, I try to contribute to that.
And that has been David Azarot, director of the B. Kenneth Simon Center for Principles in Politics and the AWC Family Foundation Fellow at the Heritage Foundation. David speaks about a nation of citizens who take ownership locally of their own communities, who truly embody what it means to self-govern. David views himself as a conservative, which he defines as a set of principles and values that place the citizen at the preeminent pinnacle of society and thinks that government ought to be accountable to that citizen, and that those citizens should self-govern and should be given the respect they deserve in order to self-govern and advance their own interests as they see fit. In his worldview, conservatism makes room for a multiplicity of views. David mentions diversity and the importance of diversity in a democracy, both demographically and a diversity of views. David dedicates himself to advancing the public interest and improving society because for him, that is what America is all about. And to this community, which he has come to accept and love, he hopes to make it better as anyone would seek to make a community better of which they feel such a strong connection. So, David, I'd like to thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
And this has been Episode 92, a Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. Thanks for joining us, and we'll talk to you next time.